This week's episode of Taste Radio is brought to you by Simrise Californulations.
If you're looking to bring new beverages to life, look no further than Californulations.
Californulations is the Simrise creative incubator concept that gives beverage entrepreneurs access to the development expertise of one of the largest and most experienced flavor companies in the world.
Californulations is a complete bench-to-bottle solution that bundles rapid prototyping, formulation development, and scale-up support into a single package.
With Californulations, Simrise gives entrepreneurs access to resources that are not normally available to new and emerging brands, including full beverage formulation development, consumer insights, regulatory support, purchasing power, and of course, world-class beverage flavors.
And they do it all from an inspirational studio in Laguna Beach, California.
To learn more about this new and exciting offer, visit californulations.com.
The room block for BevNet Live and Nosh Live Winter 2018 at the famous Loews Santa Monica Hotel is now open to anyone holding a ticket. Register today at bevnetlive.com and noshlive.com to reserve your room.
And now Taste Radio.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to BevNet's Taste Radio. I'm Ray Latif, and you're tuning into episode 125 of the podcast. This week, we go behind the scenes at one of the fastest growing restaurant chains in America with Zach Koff, the Chief Operating Officer of Shake Shack. Next, we hear from Zach Normandin, the CEO of direct-to-consumer brand Dirty Lemon, who takes us on a deep dive inside its innovative detox to your doorstep business model. Joining me later in the show are my Taste Radio co-hosts, John Craven, Mike Schneider, and John Landis, chat about current news at BevNet HQ. Just a reminder to our listeners, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send an email to ask@tasteradio.com. I remember the first time I walked into a Shake Shack. It didn't look or feel like your typical hamburger chain. You know, the ones where the air is thick with grease and on every table is a wad of crumpled napkins and ketchup stains. No, Shake Shack was different. It felt sleek and premium. And the food was different. Not necessarily healthier, but there was an obvious emphasis on quality. And while that quality came at a higher price point than other chains, it was clear from the winding lines of customers waiting to fork over their money that plenty of people were willing to pay for a better burger. Shake Shack has become one of the most beloved and fastest-growing restaurant chains in the U.S., and I was interested to learn about how the company has maintained its high standards and rapport with customers while continuing to expand its reach with new locations. I spoke with Shake Shack's Chief Operating Officer, Zach Koff, about the company's mission and business philosophy, how it curates its menu and strategy for building brand loyalty, and why the company isn't planning on a plant-based burger anytime soon. All right, I'm going to call with Zach Koff, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Shake Shack. Zach, thank you so much for being with us on Taste Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I got to ask this straight up. How does one become the Chief Operating Officer of Shake Shack?
You know, it starts with making a lot of burgers and spinning a lot of shakes. And, you know, I started at the fourth location in Miami Beach when we opened there, which was the first restaurant outside of New York City. And, wow, we've just kind of grown up all through the country throughout. And, you know, over the years, I've seen a lot of openings and helped with a lot of operations and helped develop a lot of great people. And that just ultimately led to, let's go big. Let's try to run this whole thing.
You're currently in the midst of a big growth period for Shake Shack. It seems like the chain has been growing quite a bit over the years. How many stores, how many locations do you have right now?
We've got 178 locations, with 110 of those in the United States and 68 abroad.
Wow. And what's your plans for the rest of the year? I mean, how many more locations are you looking to open up?
Yeah, we've got a few more than 20 domestically this year. And man, we are just on pace to just keep opening and opening all over the world here.
So just keeping you busy day and night, sounds like.
All day long.
Well, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes with us for this podcast interview. And, you know, one of the questions that really came to mind when we were thinking about Shake Shack is that it has done so well to sell indulgent food. I mean, I go in there and I'll get a burger and fries. And I think the last time I was there, I had a peach cobbler milkshake, which was amazing. So it feels a little incongruent with the fact that U.S. consumers are increasingly health conscious and reducing consumption of calories, sugar, and in some cases, meat. So what is Shake Shack's appeal to consumers?
You know, for us, it's always about balance. We never expect people to eat a cheeseburger every single day, but we've always held that, you know, the day that they do, we just think they want to eat something great and delicious and that they feel good. And we just want to be that burger. And look, I think everybody's super conscious of what they're putting into their bodies and they want real ingredients. And ever since the beginning, we've made it our mission to make sure that's exactly what we're using. And we use, you know, high quality premium ingredients from the best ranchers, farmers, bakers. You know, everything is 100% all natural and no hormones, antibiotics. We use cage-free eggs, no GMOs. I mean, all the things that are going into these indulgent items are great ingredients. And I think that resonates for the people who are thinking about just what they're going to eat. But man, when they want a cheeseburger, they still want it to taste great. And that's what we hope, you know, they trust us for every single time.
For sure. So, I mean, do you ever consider Shake Shack to be, say, a healthy fast casual restaurant chain or a healthy restaurant chain?
There's a million ways to define what healthy means to people. I think for us, it's always about, you know, were we really thoughtful in the items that we chose to put together? I mean, you know, beef is always just going to be beef, and it's made out of things that it's made out of, but at least we chose the most thoughtful animal that's the most humanely raised and from the greatest farmers and ranchers. And so is it healthy food? Hey, look, if it makes you feel great every day, you know, I would consider that health. But, you know, we tell everybody it's all about balance.
Fair enough. You know, we see new food ingredients, new food trends popping up every day. You know, some have some staying power. Others, you know, they're a flash in the pan. So how does Shake Shack look at these food trends and ingredients? How do you incorporate them into your menu, and or do you incorporate them into your menu?
I think we're in a unique position. I mean, our core menu remains the same pretty much across our locations, but, you know, we do some adventurous things that, you know, our brand and sort of our culinary roots have allowed us to do. And we're part of a great peer network of some of the greatest chefs in the world. And I think that came a lot from our fine dining roots. And because we're Shake Shack, I think we've had the chance to be super playful with those relationships. And you'll see collaborations and partnerships that are just so fun. And, you know, our collabs happen to be, you know, sometimes they are flash in the pan moments, but really, really fun moments. I mean, we partnered with Fergus Henderson from St. John. We did a smoked eel burger, you know, one day, and we've partnered with Rosio Sanchez, and, you know, we did a breakfast taco one day. So the chefs, who I think are some of the most creative people in the world, we've had this chance to really have a lot of fun with them and our brand. So that helps us stay fun and relevant for culinary trends. And then, you know, there's just other things that our guests are asking for also. And we've introduced things like chili or barbecue, hot chicken. And some of those are longer lasting items that we try out. And, you know, we give them a little run, and certain things have become super popular and landed on the menu permanently, like our chicken shack. But for the most part, you know, our core is really strong and we like to keep a little variety, but mostly we're just trying to have fun with that stuff more than anything.
Did you say eel burger as an E-E-L?
I did. It was actually one of the most fascinating days we had. You wouldn't believe how many people lined up to try that. And I think people trust us to take a little adventure. They know we have some deep relationships with these, you know, really collaborative chefs. And, you know, if you're going to try an eel burger, I think you're going to at least try a Shake Shack before anywhere else.
Yeah, I guess. Well, one of the things that recently came onto your menu was a veggie burger. When did you launch that?
So that's just a couple months old now. And it's actually, you know, technically it's our second vegetarian sandwich. You know, the shroom burger, which has been on our menu since the beginning, was really our first stab at attracting the meatless crowd. And when we created that, it was always about, man, you know, the satisfaction that someone gets from a cheeseburger. You know, what could a vegetarian, what kind of satisfaction could we create for that person? And the shroom burger has really played that role for a very long time. But it's definitely not a light item, I think, that a lot of the vegetarian trends that are happening now. So we created this, the Veggie Shack. It's a couple months old, and we've rolled it out to a little more than a dozen locations now. We're so early on in really understanding what it is and really getting the word out for people to try. But we are incredibly proud of the product itself. We think it's interesting. And it's really, it's an item that the vegetarian burger lover, and let's just say it's the person who wants to experience Shake Shack like other people want to experience Shake Shack. And that's like with fries and a milkshake. You kind of want to feel like you're part of the crowd. And so that's why we went with this particular veggie burger. It sort of looks and feels the part like the rest of the menu does.
But does it actually look and feel the part of a hamburger or a cheeseburger? And, you know, that's something that we're seeing plant-based meat companies try to embody, which is they don't want to just be a veggie burger. They want to be a hamburger in look, feel, taste being most important. You know, what's your take on some of these emerging plant-based meat alternatives like a Beyond Meat or an Impossible Burger, which we're already seeing on menus at other fast casual restaurants?
Yeah, you see it in a lot of places. And, you know, we admire both of those companies, and we met with them as well. And we actually believed that their product would work in a lot of different places. And that was almost one of the reasons why we chose to do something ourselves instead, because, you know, for us, there was something about having control of the flavor and the texture and really creating something on our own that we believed in because it was sort of built from the bottom up. So, you know, kudos to those guys for what they're doing. I think it's incredible. But, you know, our route was really about, you know, answering what felt right for our soul. And that's always been creating things our own and trying to answer the same thing they're trying to answer. But we still like vegetables. Our patty is just vegetables put together. I'm not really trying to extract them differently. And, you know, we love what we created. We're super excited for the early results of how everybody's liked it so far.
Have you tested out internally any kind of plant-based meat burgers?
Only through tastings. You know, our culinary team, we went through a few of them, and just it didn't feel like us at the time when we were going through it while we were creating, you know, a veggie burger ourselves. And we chose that route. We were a lot more proud of the route we took.
Do you feel like it's not something that is in line with what your customers want at this point because it doesn't exactly replicate the appearance and taste of your hamburgers?
You know, I think what people come to Shake Shack for is a unique experience. And, you know, the only thing about like the Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger, I think because you can get that other places, that's what really felt a little less special to us. And I think our guests count on us for something different and something more driven by our culinary roots and not necessarily a kind of interpretation of somebody else's.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with Zach Koff after this short break.
Nosh Live is a two-day business and networking event for the natural foods industry. Held this winter in Santa Monica on November 29th and 30th. Learn more at noshlive.com.
So how do you most effectively interact with your consumers beyond just serving them consistent, great food?
Yeah, you know, I think in person is probably the best way. You know, we have some of the most incredible team members out there and the incredible leaders of our teams who are hired because they are emotionally great people. I think the skill set of teaching somebody to run a restaurant and, you know, cook the food we do, I think anybody can do that. I think finding the people who you want to hang out with and you want to talk to and you want to have just interaction with, that's the art that I think we've done a really good job and really held as one of our skills to find those right people. So, you know, getting the right people in front of, you know, our guests is probably the best way to interact with our consumers. But, you know, we also grew up in this sort of social world. As social media was coming on board, I'll never forget, you know, at Madison Square Park where the line was just always long and people just kept taking pictures of themselves standing in line and they wanted to share the experience of where they were and what they were doing. And that has just exploded ever since those early stages of people just wanting to share that they were part of something. And we have just incredible social engagement. The amount of user-generated content is just enormous. And then, you know, newly, you know, in our new digital channels, we're really keen on trying to connect with our guests wherever and, you know, whenever they want to connect with us. And that's been through our app and through upcoming digital channels as well. You know, there's just other times people want to talk to Shake Shack and be a part of Shake Shack, you know, sometimes without being in line or without being in the restaurants. And gosh, we're excited about the early stages of really finding these ways to connect with our very digital savvy guest base.
You mentioned that being in person and educating your employees on how to interact with your guests is critical. I'm curious as to how you instill that desire for hospitality, that need for hospitality that is so important in food service, but really sounds really particularly important for Shake Shack.
Yeah, so I think a lot of that comes just from our roots. You know, we came from Union Square Hospitality Group, and, you know, it's a culture of what was coined enlightened hospitality. And there's just some core tenets in there that just resonate with our team because they're just so obvious about how to interact with people and take care of people. And we look for those kinds of employees who embrace that. And that's just about having, you know, good work ethic and a smile and empathy and compassion. We're very good at finding those traits in people in the interview process. And the more of that group you have within your team, it's sort of contagious within the four walls of the restaurant. So the more people you have like that, everything rises together. And our managers know it, our teams know it, and it's just a positive environment to work in. And all of that spills over into the guest. And that's always been sort of one of the core tenets of Life Hospitality is when your team feels good, they actually have the capacity to go beyond themselves and then take care of the guests. And it's an easy concept for a lot of our team to understand because it's such a feel-good concept, but it really works.
It's easy when you can give out free food, too. And I read once that Randy Garrudy once challenged employees at a new location to give away so much food that I think he said, quote, it would put the company out of business. What was the strategy there?
What he actually said was he challenged everybody in the restaurant to put us out of business with generosity. And it's a great concept of really just reminding everybody, if you take care of somebody this way, or, you know, kids crying and you give them a scoop of custard, or, you know, the cutest person in the world and you give them a onesie, or, you know, you park someone's stroller in the back office, or just whatever it is you do, none of that little stuff will ever add up to be too expensive for the value that it's created. And, you know, it's a great frontline tactic for our team to understand that there's really nothing that's in there. They can't give away enough to actually put us out of business. And a lot of people just don't realize that. And they don't realize that the value of anything that they do is so much greater than maybe the cost of it. And that's just like an extreme way of saying it. And last time I checked, I think we were still in pretty good business. So the hospitality's been good and nobody's giving away too much yet.
That's a good thing, because I think a lot of people would be upset if the reason that you closed is because you gave away too much food.
Yeah. And it goes beyond food, though, too. I mean, the best things about generosity that we've always talked about is really time. It's really the time that you give. You know, that costs things as well, but that's really the most valuable thing that our teams can give anybody is attention and care and time.
When it comes to the Shake Shack brand, what are the key elements of maintaining that brand integrity, particularly as you continue to grow and it becomes much more important for you to stay consistent with how you are in front of customers and then how customers see you when they're not at the restaurant?
You know, we have a very simple thing that we do. I mean, you know, we cook incredibly thoughtful food and we just try to offer it with such graciousness and hospitality. And by building spaces that are thoughtful and gracious to their environments and their communities, you know, if you boil it down to just the ease of what it is we do, that helps us protect everything. I mean, at the end of the day, it goes back down to just such basics. It's about great food and a great environment with great people. And if you can just continue to achieve that, that just never goes out of style. It just really never goes out of style. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned great food a few different times. I mean, what are some of the fastest growing items on your menu and why are they so popular?
Yeah, I think the only thing that's made it onto the menu recently in the last decade almost has been the Chicken Shack. And that started as really a limited time offer. It was our take on, you know, fried chicken. It was the first chicken item to come onto the menu. And, you know, we had ravenous results. In the early days of testing that. In fact, we ran out our first weekend we were doing it. for lines around the corner. And then we realized we were onto something. So that one came onto the menu early last year. And it's really just, you know, the more and more people now choose Shake Shack for chicken as much as they choose it for burgers and fries right now. So that's just been a great success story. And it's allowed us a new platform to launch other sort of specials on top of it. We've done hot chicken and we've done some chef collaborations with that item as well. And it's just been a lot of fun to add to the menu.
Mm-hmm. And I want to circle back to one thing that we talked about right at the top of this interview, which was this notion of indulgence. And we had a guest on the podcast a few episodes back who mentioned Shake Shack by name. It was the owner of an indulgent ice cream brand, and he was going the opposite direction of some of these brands that we're seeing today, like a Halo Top, which is just killing it on the market. But he said, look, you know, people really love ice cream for what it is, a very indulgent dessert. And he said, you know, a parallel to what we do is what Shake Shack does is, you know, we're offering people what they want. We're offering them, you know, the indulgence of a hamburger and fries, and in some cases a shake. And he called this sort of the backlash to the backlash, is I think the term he used. Do you feel like you're in that category where, you know, consumers are still health conscious, but they don't want it in every aspect of their life? And I know you mentioned balance, but do you feel like you're part of that backlash to the backlash?
I don't, you know, it's hard to say. I think that, you know, and you think about it, you go on vacation or if you've got kids, like, you know what the things that everybody wants are. It's the same things. If you had the choice of anything in the world, you still would go for ice cream, or you would go for something that just is a little indulgent, makes you feel good. I think that those things will always exist. Craveable is always craveable. And there's just certain things that, you know, you're always going to crave more than others. The challenge, and I just like we talked about, you know, in this day and age, I think people, you know, have, rightfully so, have chosen not to have indulgences every day and all day long. But they still want the right one when it's the right time for one. So it might just be fewer occasions of, you know, the indulgent moment in their lives. But again, like when you do want it, it better be worth it. It better be good. And you know, we believe that's the one that we're providing.
Outstanding. Well, Zach, I really appreciate you taking the time, and good luck with the continued expansion of Shake Shack. I know I'll be a part of it when I munch down a burger and fries in the very near future.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take it easy. While Dirty Lemon, which markets functional beauty and detox beverages, is perhaps best known for an eye-catching and occasionally risque Instagram account and its high-profile collaboration with Vogue magazine, the company has caught the attention from many in the food and beverage industry for a direct consumer distribution model that aims to upend traditional routes to market. We first spoke with Dirty Lemon's co-founder and CEO, Zach Normandin, back in episode 50 of the podcast. And in the following interview, John Craven and Mike Schneider follow up on that conversation with this one, which features a deep dive into the company's business and marketing strategy.
This is Mike, and I'm here with John Craven and the CEO of Dirty Lemon, Zach Normandin. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about Dirty Lemon.
So we launched Dirty Lemon in 2015, and I've been in food and beverage for about 10 years now, and started my first brand in 2008. We were selling products into Whole Foods and Target, so it's a kids' snack food company. And, you know, I was able to experience through that process, you know, what it takes to basically get products into stores. Mm-hmm. So you have to present a product to a buyer and the buyer approves it. And basically from that point, you go through the process of getting the product onto store shelves, which as a young brand competing with larger companies, I found that to be just a very slow process. So we were coming up with a lot of cool new ideas and then we would get a lot of them approved, but, you know, it would take sometimes up to a year to get the products onto store shelves. So I sold that brand in 2013. And was really thinking about ways to do things a little bit differently and saw a lot of direct-to-consumer companies coming up and was really intrigued by this idea of selling at scale to a national consumer base without having to go through retailers. I mean, anyone who works in food and beverage knows that just even the process of managing UNFI or KeHE is just a nightmare. So I was trying to alleviate all those things, and I've always been fascinated by beverage. I think beverage is a really exciting branding opportunity. So I think the beverages that consumers choose say something about who they are as people. So I think that consumers self-identify with the beverages that they drink.
So it sounds like you came up with an idea first about how you wanted to do distribution, and then the beverage came afterwards. You said you have this fascination with the beverage industry, but the first thing you mentioned was the distribution model. Was there a white space in beverage that you saw that said, hey, I need to do this kind of beverage and in a direct-to-consumer model? Or tell us a little bit about how Dirty Lemon came about.
So which came first, the DTC or the beverage?
Right.
So the beverage came first, but the beverage has actually become a secondary part of the overall, proposition of the company right now. But I'll tell that story. So what I was seeing in the beverage space was that juice cleanses prior to Dirty Lemon were extremely popular, but the people that were drinking juice cleanses were not actually following this idea of a juice cleanse at all. So, people were saying that they were on a juice cleanse, which meant that, in the morning they would drink a green juice, and then at lunchtime they'd have a salad. Maybe they would do a workout in the afternoon, and then by dinner time they would be eating pizza and drinking wine. And that was basically the juice cleanse for most New Yorkers. And so the concept I had for a brand was to basically flip this idea of a cleanse on its head and make the anti-cleanse. So something that had a powerful ingredient profile that fit into the lifestyle of the modern consumer. So we formulated the first beverage, which was charcoal. And really around this whole idea of, this is not a cleanse, with a lot of the same kind of fundamental ideas of a cleanse behind it, but it was marketed in a much different way. We knew that if we were selling a beverage direct to consumer, we needed to have a very easy way to allow consumers to purchase the product and then also have them come back and repurchase it again. And we didn't want to launch with a subscription because we didn't want consumers to feel like they were getting locked in. I thought through, well, what can we do? So we can either have an app, we could have a standard shopping cart, like a Shopify checkout, and really just started brainstorming all the different ways that you could allow for a frictionless purchasing process, and explored what was happening specifically in Asia with WeChat. I thought it was really interesting that WeChat was being used as a payment processor, also a messaging platform. I mean, it was basically like it was like Venmo meets iMessage meets
It's like a Swiss Army knife of apps.
Right, all together in one thing. And so a lot of our inspiration to build the platform that we've developed was kind of inspired by WeChat. But yeah, so we developed a technology platform and launched that with the beverage when we first started. That allowed people to purchase the product over text message. We didn't want to develop a messaging app per se, but we wanted to have a messaging interface that was ubiquitous with anyone who had a cell phone could use, could order the product without having to download anything or have any friction points, having to log in or anything like that. So we launched the product, Dirty Lemon plus Charcoal, in 2015. The only way to purchase the product was over text message. And we saw incredible success right off the bat with the product. There were definitely challenges with the tech at a very early stage, but we saw a lot of success. And then we started thinking about, okay, well, what's the mind state of the consumer that's purchasing this product? They're looking to have access to a functional ingredient or in this case it was charcoal, but they wanted the convenience of that in a ready-to-drink beverage.
You've mentioned this several times in the interview that the feeling of the customer. Mm-hmm. How do you know what the feeling of the customer is? How do you know what the feeling of the Dirty Lemon customer is or the potential Dirty Lemon customer?
It's just intuition and just perception of what consumers like. And, that being said, I think we're in a very, very interesting time right now in the history of brands where consumers are starting to be desensitized by brands in general. And they want familiarity, but they also want new things. And I think it's very challenging as a brand to break through all that clutter and actually present something that's simplistic. And I think that's something that we've done well just by paring back our branding and having it really just focus on the main primary functional ingredient in each of the beverages. It's allowed us to, I think, kind of stand out in a space that's extremely crowded. This is something that I'm thinking about all the time, is how do we connect with a changing the changing psyche of the modern consumer.
Well, as you've built up a base of your consumers and you're doing this direct-to-consumer model, what kind of communication stream do you have with that audience and what are you learning?
We've kind of brought together this really wonderful marriage of the technology that consumers are coming to expect from the brands that they spend the most time with, and also this kind of old world communication method that I think made the most powerful brands really stand out in cluttered grocery store settings.
So you're trying to establish a one-to-one relationship with the customer. How's that working?
It's working wonderfully. I mean, that's...
What are you learning? I'm so curious about this.
I mean, there's so much. There's product specific. Just by having direct access to consumers, we're able to ask questions and get immediate feedback on new products. We can ask, like, you've both received emails where it's like, you know, how would you recommend this to a friend? You know?
Sure.
Like, we have the ability to actually say, hey, John, you know, I'd love to, you know, ask you a couple questions. If you're willing to answer the questions, we'll give you a $20 coupon on your next order, or we'll give you a free case or whatever it may be. And then we can actually start to gather immediate real-time feedback on different things. Like, for example, you know, we made a decision last year to move to VIP pricing. So we had customers that had spent thousands and thousands of dollars on the product, and we were trying to figure out, how do we monetize those customers further? Why are they not purchasing more? They're spending, you know, $3,000 over the course of a year. How do we get them to spend $5,000 or whatever it might be? Mm-hmm. And we surveyed probably a couple hundred customers, and every single one of those high LTV customers came back to us and said, it's difficult for me to justify a $65 price point for beverages. I love the product. I'll continue to buy it, but it's difficult for me to justify that. We said, what price do you think would be a little bit like easier to bite off? And everyone said, we think like $7 to $8 would be more approachable. So we came up with the VIP program, which was a program to reward our highest LTV customers with a lower price point because they're purchasing more frequently. So that's an insight that we gained through asking specific question to a customer. We've always intentionally priced the product high. We want people to know it's a high quality product. They're receiving an elevated experience with the product. They're getting it direct to their door or their workplace or wherever they want to have it delivered.
This is a situation where retention and loyalty is a thing you can work on in-house versus having to go outside to get third-party feedback to figure out how to do that.
Every tool and everything that we've used to grow the company over the last 2.5 years, we've built in-house. And it's all been a reaction to things that were happening in the company, which is really exciting. And through that process, we've collected data that no beverage company has. I mean, we have consumption data and insights into consumer behavior in the beverage space that no other beverage company has. That's the big companies too, Coke and Pepsi included. You know, we started with a beverage, but we've realized that the most valuable piece of this is actually the tech infrastructure that drives everything that we're doing. We wanna bring innovative beverages to consumers before the retailers can keep up with it, right? So if an ingredient like CBD becomes popular or it's buzzy in the food space, we wanna have the first, you know, ready to drink CBD beverage. And we have an infrastructure in place that can support national demand for our product. And we can launch those products in, you know, in 30 days, which is something that, I mean, we can identify a trend, launch the product, get it out to consumers, get immediate feedback, and then tweak things as we go. And that's an innovation cycle that retailers are going to have a hard time touching. So
sure. So when we started talking, you were talking about how it's, you know, it's slow and it's costly to go out and, let's say, focus on traditional, you know, retail, right? They're slow, et cetera. You know, some of the companies that you've mentioned, you know, Amazon, Postmates, et cetera, have, you know, certainly focused on being more innovative as well as, you know, quick delivery, right? Mm-hmm. So could those become outlets for beverage retail, which I know some of them already are, that would, in effect, be an advantage over Dirty Lemon that has to build a one-to-one relationship?
Yeah, I think Amazon, to every grocery brand, Amazon is maybe not a threat, but it's something that needs to be considered. I think Amazon is our biggest competitor right now, but the benefit that we have is that we own the brands that we're selling. So our vision is to have many different beverages that we can be launching underneath one platform where we own the customer data and the experience, and we can offer those products, you know, to consumers. And we're conditioning that behavior with consumers right now. So like, it's our vision that there will be multiple conglomerates that will exist similar to Unilever, Coca-Cola, you know, Frito-Lay, whatever it may be. We think that those are going to exist in direct consumer models similar to what we're building, and they will compete with Amazon for specific product categories. So there could be a little mini Unilever that just handles bathroom products, you know, toilet paper, you know, shampoo, conditioner, et cetera. And when you want, maybe not for us, but, you know, when you want more, you're either going to have that on subscription or whatever it may be, because we think that the Amazon experience is very commoditized and consumers are actually looking for, they are looking for that elevated experience, which is why we've had a lot of success, is because we've tapped into, like, you know, that need state for consumers that isn't being met by other digital channels like Amazon.
Well, do you get many requests from your consumer base of, gee, are you ever going to sell this in 7-Eleven or Target or on Amazon, because
never happened one time.
Never.
We sell the product on Amazon, but we look at Amazon as a profitable customer acquisition channel. Mm-hmm. So we're selling our product on Amazon for $65 a case. And, you know, our VIP program on the website, it's $45 a case.
Gotcha.
So we want to acquire customers. I mean, it's no secret that when people find out about new products, they go to Amazon first, they look at reviews, you know, they check out the pricing and stuff. So, I mean, we still control distribution. We don't use any distributors for selling the product. So since we have one single channel, we can dictate the price. We actually ship it from our warehouse network right now. So we're not utilizing the Amazon distribution network. And yeah, the idea there is that people will find out about us through Amazon. We obviously make a profit on that sale, and then they're going to come to us direct to purchase the product.
And then operate like a normal Dirty Lemon customer.
Exactly, right.
Gotcha.
We'll be right back with Zach Normandin after this quick break.
Natural food companies. Hire your next great team member by listing your job on the Project Nosh job board. Visit projectnosh.com/jobs to learn more and list your job.
The customer of the brand right now, mm-hmm. does it align with the original thesis of who would be the Dirty Lemon customer?
Yeah, it's almost identical to who we were. We always wanted the Dirty Lemon brand to be viewed through the lens of a woman. So I think the kiss of death for a lot of brands is actually having too much of a male consumer base, because it actually isolates the female consumer base. And I think women are the trend-setting. They're the purchasers, and men typically are the follow-on consumers. And there are categories, obviously, where that doesn't necessarily true. But I think for the most part, trends start because women start, you know, utilizing, whether it's a, you know, an exercise class or a specific brand. I mean, look at like Lululemon, SoulCycle. Like, I mean, you could just keep going on and on, you know. And then I think the trickle down actually goes to men. So we always wanted the target consumer to be predominantly female. And yeah, and it is. So we have an 80% plus consumer base of female consumers.
Do you mean that you are predominantly targeting women, or that women are the predominant customer of Dirty Lemon?
So women are the consumers of Dirty Lemon, because the brand was created for the female consumer intentionally. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the history of male targeted beverages, it's like Red Bull, Monster.
Shocking.
You know, yeah. Red Bull, Monster. I'm trying to think of
some sports drinks, maybe.
Others. Yeah. Yeah, Gatorade.
Gatorade, of course.
And I think that those beverages, when you look at the beverage space specifically, they're not attractive to the female consumer because they were very much targeted to men.
Jones Pork Soda.
Yes. It doesn't mean that males aren't attracted to the brand. I think that more sophisticated consumers actually prefer Dirty Lemon. We have a lot of male consumers. I drink Dirty Lemon multiple times a day.
I hope so.
It's my beverage of choice. But yeah, it's not. I don't think that men will ever be the majority of consumers for the Dirty Lemon product.
So the brand is clearly meant to be high-end. It's glamorous. Recently, you worked with Vogue, mm-hmm. and you've been in the hands of supermodels, and you worked with Cardi B during one campaign.
Right.
Can you talk to us about how that campaign came about, and then mm-hmm. also a little bit about the impact? Since you're DTC, you can see the impact.
Sure. You know, we found that there to be a lot of alignment between the Vogue consumer and the Dirty Lemon consumer. Vogue, historically, if you look at any fashion media, Vogue is perceived as the highest quality of any media outlet in the fashion. And it's really become a lifestyle brand now. So we saw a lot of alignment naturally between the Vogue consumer, or the Vogue reader, and the Dirty Lemon consumer. And we started discussing, we were naturally building a relationship with them because we were giving our products to the editorial staff and, you know, to have it featured in Vogue. And there was a natural alignment with both of the brands. And then we started discussing a collaboration. This was probably the middle of 2017. And then that product launched at the beginning. So we had our launch party at the end of 2017 with Cardi B. And that product launched earlier this year.
You just made friends with Vogue, and next thing you know, you're with Cardi B.
That was it. But I will say, so we've attracted an incredible group of investors and advisors around the company, many of which are in entertainment or music space. And I take a lot of pride in this. The Cardi B party specifically, and every other activation that we've done, is entirely produced in-house. I mean, Vogue was obviously able to benefit from our efforts through that. But, you know, we booked Cardi, we planned the whole party, we rented out an entire townhouse in Soho. You know, because we don't sell through grocery stores, we have really healthy gross margins that we can, you know, we can take the profits from the sale of the product, and we can actually put them into experiences that are going to retain and keep our customers attracted to the brand.
Do you get the 3 or 4x return you want on something like that?
I mean, I think because of the strategic connections we had, it's actually not, it wasn't as expensive as you would think. Mm-hmm. And when you start to, I mean, having been in the grocery space, when you start to think of free filling of region of Whole Foods or national Whole Foods or offering a promo at Target or whatever it may be, these are comparable costs. And what we're able to do through these efforts is actually create an experience that people are going to talk about, and it's going to garner media attention and all of these different things. And that, so maybe it's not an immediate 3 to 4x return, but it keeps the brand elevated and at a place where consumers almost want to know, like, well, what's next? What else are you guys going to do? And that's a great place to be as a brand, because it pushes us, it drives us to actually be always thinking progressively about, okay, what can we do to one-up Cardi B?
Beyonce?
We got to figure out what that is.
Well, can you give any insight into the Dirty Lemon as a technology company? Because I feel like we're kind of oversimplifying. We're talking about the costs that have gone away by not being in a store, but I'm guessing you live in a world of, you know, I don't know, software releases and expensive,
absolutely,
you know, developers and stuff. So how does that part of the business model fit in?
So that is our business. We are a technology company. We monetize the business through the sale of beverage products.
Sure.
But at our core, we are a technology-enabled distribution platform. And the vision is to reinvent consumer distribution, consumer product distribution. Because we think that there is a layer of fat in that system that does not need to be there in order to actually properly cater to customers. So if you look at distribution, brokerage, retail, I mean, these are things that don't need to be a part of the process of connecting with a consumer, but just the history of food and beverage and grocery, it's very much ingrained in the way that you do business, but it doesn't need to be that way. And we're proving that every day, that you can actually provide a high quality product with a very good brand and actually offer your consumers something more than what they would get at a grocery store, and achieve the scale that, you know, the same scale that we would get at a Target or a Whole Foods. We are in a 2% bracket of beverage brands. So of the beverage brands that are launched every year, and we have this data because we've talked to a number of strategics now, that there are 2% of beverage brands that make it to the place that we're at right now. And the fact that we've done that without the assistance of retail tells me that there is a massive opportunity here that we're only scratching the surface of.
Well, it's certainly interesting in that the consumer, of course, only sees the product. They don't really see much of an interface or presence in a store.
Right.
And I guess in some ways you could say you're using beverages to fund development of a game-changing tech platform.
This is why we wanted to price the product. You know, if we started with a lower price point product, it would have been much more challenging. Like, for the first year, we subsidized shipping costs to the tune of, we had one warehouse in the Northeast, and we were shipping everywhere, wow, 1 to 2 day air everywhere around the country. So some of our shipping costs were $40. For an entire year, we did that. But the reason why we were able to absorb those costs is because we had, you know, we have good gross margins, and we didn't have to give 30% to a distributor and 30% to a retailer. So yeah, I think this is a technology company. We're very much focused on continued development of the tech. We're looking to make more acquisitions in the tech space. I think that there are a number of companies that are focused on messaging, but they haven't found their monetization strategy that allows them to kind of reach the potential that they want to. Yeah, I think we have a real shot at completely disrupting the way that beverages are purchased and sold by brands.
Beverage company, tech company, investor. This is a very complex company.
It is. I mean, at some point, could you sell off the Dirty Lemon brand and just be a tech company?
No, the vision is to have Dirty Lemon always be under the platform. I look to inspiration at, you know, Diageo and Coca-Cola and, you know, Pepsi, all these bigger beverage companies that have used common operational infrastructure to launch and grow many different brands, hundreds of brands.
And if you think about it, you always have that one brand that you is your brand, your baby, you can do whatever you want with. So it's kind of your ball of clay. If you want to test a new feature, you can always test it with Dirty Lemon.
Right.
So one last thing that's on my mind, since, you know, you're a guy, obviously, who's very focused on tech, aside from, you know, let's say the obvious of Amazon, or what tech companies do you look at right now and admire what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think we're taking inspiration in a lot of different fields. I mean, I don't have a clear answer for this, so maybe it doesn't make sense, but I'm inspired very much by what's happening with my kids every day. So when, you know, if one of my children wants to order a meal from one restaurant and another one wants to order a meal from another restaurant and another one wants to order a meal from the other one, they can all order different meals and they actually come at the same time, sometimes from the same delivery driver from different restaurants. And that is fascinating to me. And I think that when you see the success of Uber Eats and Postmates and all these different delivery, you know, apps, you start to put yourself in this mindset of, you start to see where, how consumers are being conditioned to experience brands. And a lot of what we're trying to replicate is that same type of, so we're testing right now same day deliveries in New York and LA. So in some situations, if you order Dirty Lemon, you'll get a text message from us saying, would you like to, you know, we see that you're within a same day delivery window. Would you like to have the product delivered to where you are right now within the next 3 hours? And you could be like, sure. Yeah, that's great. That's our ultimate goal over the next year. We want same day deliveries in all the major markets. So if you look at high consumption beverages, people buy cases of these products. I mean, it's like, you know, look at LaCroix or look at, you know, Harmless Harvest when it was like really at its peak. People were going into Whole Foods and filling up entire shopping carts full of Harmless Harvest. Same thing with LaCroix. I mean, there's, you know, so much so that there's an entire section of Whole Foods full of LaCroix. You know, imagine if you didn't have to go through that unnecessary step of having to go into a grocery store and all that product was delivered to you with the shipping subsidized in the cost of the product. And
you're not having to care where it came from.
Exactly. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And that's, we're not the first ones to offer delivery at home by any means. But I do think that when you apply delivery at home to an industry as antiquated as beverages, I think it really starts to change the game. And that's, you know, that's our inspiration, is really challenging the traditional system.
Zach, thanks a lot for your time. Thanks for coming into coming into BevNet to do the interview. It's really great having you here.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
As promised at the top of the show, I'm now joined by my Taste Radio co-hosts, John, and Mike. And just a quick note to our listeners, if you like what you hear on Taste Radio, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we'd love it if you could rate us on iTunes. What do you think of that? Rate us on iTunes? I think everyone should rate us on iTunes, but I think...
only if it's a good rating.
I think it should be a 5-star rating. It's got to be, right?
Obviously.
Obviously. John Landis, have you ever given us a 5-star review on iTunes?
I have not.
God, what? You're one of the hosts.
Yeah, it's like voting for yourself. I should definitely go do that.
I mean, politicians do, right? You know, politicians vote for themselves.
Or giving yourself a good Yelp review. Can we ask for Yelp reviews? Is that a thing for podcasts?
No, it's not.
I don't know if it is.
So sad. Totally kidding.
Okay. Well, don't do that. So this week, we had a nice visit to BevNet headquarters from Eric Bonin, who's the founder of Pillars Drinkable Greek Yogurt. This stuff is, I see this in the Northeast. I see this in Whole Foods all the time. John Landis, what do you know about this brand?
He's been kicking around for a couple years. The guy's got a background in dairy, worked at a couple yogurt brands, was doing some consulting and on the operations side of things while he started this brand a couple years ago. It's just him, one-man crew, and he's all the way down into, I think he said Harris Teeter. So he's getting down south and looking at opening up more chains on the East Coast. It's a pretty good product. It's 100 calories per bottle. And
per 12-ounce bottle,
yeah. Yeah, 100 calories per 12-ounce bottle. It's got 18 grams of protein and only 5 grams of sugar. So it's a high-protein, low-sugar yogurt with prebiotics, probiotics for on-the-go, kind of needing that kind of stuff, healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, it was nice of him to stop by. I know we had a brand profile written by our very own Brad Avery, who is a staff writer at BevNet. Good stuff. Also on BevNet, a big story about Body Armor, the fast-growing sports drink brand that landed a minority investment from the Coca-Cola company. So much buzz about Body Armor in that it's the only entrepreneurial sports drink brand in decades to have a realistic shot at challenging Gatorade. It was founded by Lance Collins, who we've had on the podcast, and Mike Rapoli, who we've also had on the podcast in episode 44, a really popular episode. Even to this day, we hear so many people talking about Rapoli's interview as a real motivational tool for them. He dropped one of the great quotes of all time on Taste Radio saying, "We're not here for bronze medals. It's gold or nothing." I love that.
Well, when you previously sold vitamin water to Coca-Cola for, a couple billion dollars, you don't need bronze, right?
Yeah, he already knows the taste of gold.
I think it's, in all seriousness, though, pretty impressive, what they've done. And, I guess to some extent in the industry, it's kind of the obvious outcome that, Mike would get another deal with Coca-Cola. And, it certainly makes sense for Coke to get involved with Body Armor, just again, given that it is, certainly on a path to challenging Gatorade, which wouldn't be a bad thing for Coke. So,
and it deals a bit of a blow to the new Keurig Dr. Pepper organization, losing one of their allied brands, getting taken out of that distribution network in favor of the Coke distribution system. All eyes really on Keurig Dr. Pepper right now to see how they react, see what happens to the other allied brands. I would be watching Core, in particular, the other Lance Collins brand that was in that portfolio. So we'll see what happens. It's definitely going to be interesting over the next few months. Yeah, and good for Coca-Cola VEB, their stated mission, trying to find the next billion-dollar brand. It seems like if Body Armor is actually going to threaten Gatorade, then they would definitely be in that category. So good for them, sticking to what they're trying to do.
Yeah, John Landis, as you mentioned, the Coke deal will run through Coke's Venturing Emerging Brands Incubation Unit. Read the full story on the deal on BevNet.com, penned by Marty Capiero, the assistant editor of BevNet. One other thing of note is that Kobe Bryant invested in Body Armor a few years back, and he's certainly one of its biggest ambassadors. And I checked out this Instagram post that he put out on the day of the investment, and it's pretty clear they really want to take Gatorade head on. He mentions a few things in the post itself and ends with, "Thanks, Gatorade, we'll take it from here," which is pretty bold, to say the least. That brings us to the end of episode 125. Thanks to our guests, Zach Koff and Zach Normandin. Tune in next week when we're joined by Angie Bastian, the founder of Angie's Boom Chicka Pop. Once again, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of John, Mike, and John, we'll talk to you next time.